Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and we see it's November 26th, and we're just coming back after Thanksgiving holidays. Welcome back. Hope everybody had a nice holiday. And I see that we're supposed to be covering lymphatic system today, but we started that last time, so we're just going to finish that up and then move into respiratory system. So today's the 26th. And we got a lecture on the 28th. We got two lectures next week, one lecture the week after that on December 10th. And then we have the final exam on Wednesday. It's not a cumulative exam, but it's just the last exam in here over these chapters. And these chapters are short. They're not really long like the muscle chapter and central nervous system. And they're fun chapters. Okay, you guys that are horsing around back there, shh, you might be disturbing some of the students that are listening up. So take it easier. Step outside. Anybody have a question regarding the schedule, the chapters involved? And don't forget, the Wednesday group is going to have a practicum and a lecture test on the same day. I'm trying to maybe reschedule it so that the Wednesday practicum actually gets done on Monday, but I haven't been able to do that successfully yet. Okay. So I'll keep you informed. It's still a little ways down the road. Okay, and we're doing dissections today in lab, so make sure you bring hand protection and eye protection into lab. If the 12 o'clock class, no, 12:30 class, if you don't have your gloves this afternoon, go get some gloves, please. And we have eye protection if you need to use eye protection in the room. All right, so anybody have any questions over the lymphatic system so far or the schedule? We're good? Okay, fantastic. All right, so we got done talking about the lymphatic vessels, just the gross anatomy of the right lymphatic duct and the thoracic duct and where they drain fluid from. So now we're going to start talking about lymphatic organs or lymph organs. And there was a list of them a little bit earlier on in your notes. And let's see if I can remember what some of these lymph organs are. They are lymph nodes, the spleen, the thymus gland. Lymph nodes, I said that already. What am I forgetting? Spleen, thymus, tonsils. Oh, thank you. Yeah, tonsils. We got three tonsils. Okay, some are in pairs. And then also don't forget about the mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, or MALT. That's going to be contained in various organs, right? It's not considered a lymph organ all by itself, but it's contained. These are certain lymphatic centers, for instance, within the small intestine, large intestine, anywhere where there is a mucosa. All right, and so lymph organs, including MALT, contain lymphatic tissue and composed primarily of lymphocytes. And I think you know what a lymphocyte looks like because we looked at that one in the very first week in lab. It's kind of a white blood cell, and it's nice and round, and the nucleus is really big. It just has a nice spherical nucleus on the inside, very little cytoplasm, right? And a macrophage is a shapeshifter. It's kind of a white blood cell at one time, but that is called a monocyte. We didn't look at any of those in lab. They're a little bit hard to find, but we could have if we spent a lot of time looking for it, a monocyte. And when a monocyte can crawl around inside your body, it's a shapeshifter. And when it crawls out of the circulatory system into various spaces in your body, then we call it a macrophage. And a macrophage is looking for foreign cells and foreign objects all the time. And there's other cells too, like for instance fibroblasts to lay down the reticular matrix that makes the connective part of all of these different organs. All right, lymphocytes as well as monocytes, which is a precursor to a macrophage, originate from red bone marrow. That's the kind of marrow that makes blood products. And then since blood is going through that red bone marrow, they're carried by the blood to the lymph organs. And lymph organs have very leaky capillaries. They have sinusoids, so a lot of cells and even red blood cells, right, can filter through various spaces within these lymphatic organs. And if a macrophage or a lymphocyte bumps into a foreign substance like a bacteria or virus that has the foreign antigen on the cell surface, then these germinal centers in lymph nodes and tonsils and MALT, for instance, The lymphocytes start to divide by mitosis. So they've learned how to recognize that infectious particle, and then it starts to divide, and it's able to attack those antigens and destroy those antigens and protect your body. So when we say cell division, right, you start with one cell, the parent cell, and then you have two. And then how many do you have after the next round of cell division? You get four. And then after that, you have eight. And then 16, 32. So these centers, because of mitosis, can get pretty large, including lymph nodes that I see over here. All right, so on the slide on the right, we see a lymph node. And here is the germinal center in one that contains macrophages and lymphocytes. And the job of a lymph node is to filter lymph and to process it so it doesn't have pathogens by the time it reaches the cardiovascular system. And here we can see that this lymphatic vessel looks very much like a vein because it has a valve in it. All right, so these vessels right here bring lymph into a lymph node. So these are the afferent lymph vessels. Then lymph percolates through these different areas inside the lymph node, and then it exits through the efferent lymphatic vessels right over here. Okay, so lymph has to travel through at least one of these before it's returned to the cardiovascular system. This area right here that looks like a little indentation on a lymph node that contains the exit or the efferent vessels, this is what we call the hilum or the hilus of this organ. It's just a connecting point. And this almost looks like a kidney bean, but not quite, almost like a kidney bean. And if you look at a bean, there's usually a little white spot right here where the bean was connected to the bean pod or the mother plant. And that point of connection on a seed is also called a hilum. All right, so we're just using that same terminology. All right, so here's a germinal center that can get very large. And when these lymphocytes start to divide to protect your body, we call that immune system activation. Immune system activation when macrophages or lymphocytes recognize foreign substances that are traveling through the lymphatic vessels. All right, so microorganisms stimulate lymphocyte cell division in these germinal centers, and that's what we call immune system activation. And so these lymph nodes, as they get bigger and bigger and bigger, they might actually be a little uncomfortable. And they can be palpated, and there's some areas on your body that have superficial aggregations of lymph nodes, like in the cervical region, axillary region, inguinal region. So a physician might actually palpate to get a feeling for what size those lymph nodes are, to know the extent of an infection that you might have, if it's just localized in one region of your body or if it's a systemic infection. Okay, so I talked about lymph nodes. Let's go back to tonsils. Tonsils are located, So here is nasal cavity, oral cavity, and then here is your throat, right? And then your throat or pharynx can be subdivided into three regions, the nasopharynx posterior to the nasal cavity, the oropharynx posterior to the oral cavity, and the laryngopharynx, which is just posterior to the larynx. So here is the larynx. The pharynx is known because it's a point of transit for air that we're breathing as well as food that we're eating. So both food and air can get mixed up in the pharynx, no problem. But when it gets down to this level right here, after the laryngopharynx, then food has to go into the esophagus down to the stomach and not into an airway like the trachea or the larynx. Right, so we're going to talk about that in the next chapter. And air shouldn't get down into the esophagus or to the stomach either. So at this point in time, solid food goes down the esophagus and air goes down through this airway starting with the larynx. All right, but what I was looking for, are tonsils. Where the heck are tonsils at? Okay, so we have the spleen, we have the thymus gland, and here are the tonsils. This one right here is the palatine, this one here and here are the palatine tonsils. These over here are the sublingual, okay, and this one right here is the pharyngeal tonsil. And I think I even have a better slide of these tonsils, but it just contains Yep, lymphatic tissue. So here's the pharyngeal tonsil, here are the palatines, here is the lingual tonsil. And of course, when you open up your mouth and say, ah, this is the one that you can actually see. But this one is way too superior to see, and the one in the back of the tongue, typically we don't look at. All right, so we look at the palatine tonsils. And here are these little nodes. These are the germinal centers in tonsils, right here, that can activate the immune system. Okay, I think I talked about last time when somebody has a chronically infected tonsil that they have to be removed with a tonsillectomy. And as a kid, that's a pretty easy procedure to have this one removed. Sometimes the pharyngeal tonsils, these are what we call adenoids, are removed, but not too often. And I've never heard of anybody getting their lingual tonsil removed, but I suppose that could happen. Okay. If you're a young person, that's a relatively easy procedure, but as an adult, I think you get 2 weeks off of work, which is pretty significant time off. And you probably will feel like you need those 2 weeks as well. Okay, next organ. Let me put this away. The next organ is going to be the spleen. And the spleen is located just lateral to the stomach. All right, so here is the stomach right here, and here is the spleen. It contains lymphatic tissue, and it has germinal centers, and its job is similar to lymph nodes. Lymph nodes are designed to filter lymph as it's returning to the cardiovascular system, but the job of the spleen is a little bit different. It doesn't filter lymph, it actually filters blood. Right, and it can remove old and damaged red blood cells, and it can also recognize bacteria and viruses that are in your cardiovascular system. And it has germinal centers, which can activate the immune system to attack those antigens. All right, so here is a picture of the spleen, and it just has reticular connective tissue. And what kind of tissue is reticular connective tissue in terms of strength? That's the weakest kind, right? It's the thinnest filaments. They're kind of highly branched, all right, but they're very, very weak. And here we can see the arterial supply feeding blood to these splenic cords. These are just little areas within the spleen. And then blood actually moves out of the cardiovascular system into these pools. And these pools we call sinuses. And that's why when the spleen is damaged, it hemorrhages very, very easily because of all the blood pools or sinuses that a spleen contains. And there's no collagen in the spleen, so there's no way for the spleen to recover. You can't put a suture in it, for instance, to sew it shut to stop the hemorrhage. All right, so the spleen filters red blood cells, unlike lymph nodes, which filter lymph. And in the white pulp that we have right here, as opposed to red pulp, right? The white pulp is the immune system that can be activated, and the red pulp right here can actually filter, or is responsible for filtering blood, and there's actually a reservoir of red blood cells in this area as well, so that if you do have a hemorrhage in another part of your body, these red blood cells can be put into the cardiovascular system to maintain your blood count, which can be handy under certain circumstances. All right, the thymus gland, a couple of previous slides. All right, we're not going to talk about very much, but the thymus gland is in the mediastinum, and it's an important activator of the immune system. It helps activate a special kind of lymphocyte that we call a T lymphocyte. There are two kinds of lymphocytes in your body. There are Bs and Ts. The B lymphocytes are the kind of lymphocytes that can produce antibodies, which is a biological molecule that can attack antigens. But a T lymphocyte is a cell that can recognize an antigen, and the cell actually attaches and destroys the antigen. So one is an antibody, just a relatively small molecule produced by a B lymphocyte, and the T lymphocyte actually has to come in contact with the cell, the microorganism that's infecting a person's body. All right, so that's it for lymphatic system. We couldn't finish that up last time. So tonsils, lymph nodes, spleen, thymus gland, and then MALT, you have all over your body. So for instance, where do you have malt? That's what all of these little things represent. Oh, the appendix too. We could consider that an organ, but it contains malt. So for instance, if somebody loses their spleen, the rest of these germinal centers can take over the job of that lymphatic tissue that you lost. Okay, you just for sure lose that reservoir of red blood cells and maybe a little bit of your immune system, that a person might be susceptible to infection under certain circumstances, but generally not. Okay, any questions on the lymphatic system? You're pretty good with lymphatic system? All right, we'll put that away. We'll put that away. Open this up, open that up. Okay, so we're going to move on to respiratory system. And the function of the respiratory system is to move air in and out of your lungs, right? We call that ventilation. We don't necessarily call that respiration because respiration could be a metabolic process in your body, but moving air in and out of your lungs, that's ventilation. And then once inside your lungs, there's gas exchange between the air that's in your lungs and capillaries. Okay, so there's an exchange between lungs and blood, air in lungs and the blood. And what kind of blood vessel does this exchange take place in? A capillary, because that's the only kind of blood vessel that's thin enough that allows for exchange. All right, the respiratory system, also we consider transport of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood as part of the respiratory system. And your body does this in a couple of different ways, and certainly different for oxygen and CO2. And then, of course, we inhale to get CO2 in our bodies. We exchange that in the lungs, and then that oxygen goes through the systemic circulation, and the oxygen then diffuses out of a capillary in the systemic circulation, bringing oxygen to what? Everywhere else in your body, like your brain and your heart, muscles, bone, for instance. All right, so let's talk about some of the anatomy of the respiratory system, which I see on this slide right here. This is the upper respiratory tract. The upper respiratory tract contains cartilage to hold this airway open. And the upper respiratory tract starts with a nasal cavity. And of course, then air has to pass through the throat. What's another name for throat? Pharynx, right? And then it deviates because the esophagus is usually closed unless you're swallowing in an active phase of swallowing. Okay, the esophagus is closed. It's a muscle that's closed. So air goes into the trachea because the trachea right here has cartilaginous rings. They don't go all the way around. They're kind of C-shaped. And these cartilaginous rings keep the trachea open all the time. It cannot collapse. So that when we inhale air into the pharynx, it just automatically goes into the trachea. All right, this part is what we call the larynx, and we recognize that on people because it kind of sticks out right here, and that is a certain cartilage that we're going to take a look at. All right, so this first part right here is the larynx, and then the main airway, bringing air into the thoracic cavity, is the trachea. Then I see a bifurcation right here. That bifurcation then produces something called a bronchus. And then it's going to bifurcate again, and that's going to be called a bronchus as well. And it's going to bifurcate once again, and that's going to be called a bronchus, but they have different names. The first branch is what we call a main bronchus, or primary. So here's a primary bronchus. After the second bifurcation, then we're going to call that a secondary bronchus. And then after the third bifurcation, we're going to call that a tertiary bronchus. And so you could just count from right this the junction of the trachea and the two main bronchi. All right, you see a little space right here. Why do you think we have this space? And it makes it look like the right lung is a lot bigger than the left lung. What's it going to be in this space right here? Yeah, you got to have room for your heart. And indeed, we call that the cardiac notch. It takes a notch, a big notch out of the left lung because you have more of your heart on the left side of your body than you do the right side, of course. All right, and so the right side, the right lung has three lobes, and the left lung only has two because of that cardiac notch. It's taking some of the that structure away. All right, so there's oropharynx, nasopharynx, laryngopharynx. And so we've covered all of that. Okay, the lower respiratory tract starts right here with the larynx. Let me find maybe another picture. Okay, so here is another picture. I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, it's because it shows the tonsils, it shows all the cartilages in the larynx. So here we can see the nasal cavity with a nasal concha. You can see the superior, the inferior, and the middle one. Here we can see the opening to the pharyngotympanic tube. Does anybody remember where this tube goes to? Where does this tube go? The Eustachian tube or the pharyngotympanic tube? It goes to, and even you should know the specific location. It goes to your ear, but what specific part of your ear? The middle ear, right? And so it equalizes pressure on the interior side of the tympanic membrane so that your tympanic membrane can vibrate back and forth very nicely. All right, so here is an adenoid or a pharyngeal tonsil. Here's a palatine tonsil. On either side of the uvula, that's that little like tongue that's hanging down in the back of your throat. Okay, but that little thing right smack in the middle is not a tonsil. They're bilateral on either side, and then you have one lingual tonsil, right at the base of the tongue, posterior base of the tongue. Okay, and again, you can see the nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx. All right, so now we want to concentrate on this lower respiratory tract that contains all of these blue structures, which represents cartilage. And you're familiar with this guy right here, right? What is this? Is your old pal, the, it's a bone, and that is the hyoid bone, nice horseshoe-shaped bone inside the mandible. And this is a special trapdoor right here called the epiglottis. And when you swallow something, where should that food go? Should it go in this tube, number one, or this tube, number two? Number one only, right? And that's the esophagus. Food that you're eating shouldn't end up in an airway because it could occlude that airway and then you can't breathe. And breathing is really, really good to do because you can't live very long without breathing. Right, but so when you swallow something, the epiglottis actually folds down over the opening into the larynx. That opening into the larynx is what we call the glottis. So the glottis is sort of like the pupil. It's just, the pupil is a hole in the iris, and the glottis is just a hole in the larynx that air can go through, hopefully never food. So when you swallow something, it slips right over the epiglottis into the esophagus, and then away down to the stomach it goes. Okay, now this epiglottis right here, so it protects you from choking. But I mentioned in lab that the epiglottis gets lazy. Sometimes when people swallow something, food does end up in the larynx or the trachea. And I know a lot of you guys are CPR certified, and you probably know what day of the week is this epiglottis the most lazy. What day of the week do most people choke on? Monday. That's pretty good. That's when I choke. But that's typically not when most people choke. They choke on Fridays. Okay, and they choke at a certain time on Fridays. What time? Around 5 o'clock, right around happy hour. So choking is associated with adult beverage. And not just by yourself, but you might be out with a group of coworkers, kind of horsing around, or somebody that you might do something with, a group of people, and you're familiar. Like if you were to go out this Friday and say, oh, I've got a funny story about our anatomy teacher, and you tell a story, okay, which might be kind of funny. Just as you're chewing and swallowing some nachos or a popcorn shrimp or even some popcorn, all of a sudden you start to laugh and swallow at the same time. And what do when you start laughing? You go like that and then laugh. So that's how people usually inhale food, by accident in the process of swallowing, or if they're not paying attention to what they're doing. And that's, like I said, usually associated with adult beverage. And they're usually consumed on Friday night. Saturday night would be the next most common time. So those of you that are CPR certified, that would be a good time just to kind of pay attention around in a room if you're out at your yacht club or your golf club or in a restaurant or McDonald's or anywhere. That's a very common time, okay, that people choke. And who knows how to clear somebody's airway in here that is occluded with a piece of food or something like that. Raise your hand if you know how. And what's that called? What's that called? Yell it out. Yeah, Heimlich maneuver. Okay, I heard in lab that it was renamed because the person that it was named after had his feelings hurt. He didn't want his, or her didn't want his name used. I don't know what the modern name is. I guess I'll have to do a Google on that to find out what it is. But that's just a severe chest compression, and it forces air out of your lungs, into the trachea, up into the larynx, right, and forces hopefully that material out of the larynx and even, right, through their nose or out their mouth, okay? Either one would be fantastic, and they'll thank you. But you should do something first before you do a Heimlich maneuver on somebody, because it's pretty radical kind of maneuver. You stand behind them, and with all your force, you kind of force their stomach up into their lungs and maybe lift them off the ground, which normally would be considered an assault, right? So what should you always do before you do that? Always ask first. And if they can talk to you, that means that their airway is open. But if they're starting to turn purple or blue and can't respond to your question, then you should feel comfortable doing a Heimlich maneuver on them. Okay, because part of the larynx right here has a couple folds that we call vocal folds. One is a very tough ligament. It vibrates back and forth when air passes over it, and that vibration produces a tone, right? Produces vocalization. There's a special cartilage that can adjust the tone or adjust the tension on that true vocal cord that's called the arytenoids. I can't quite see it on this slide, but I'll show you a picture of it. Right, and when the arytenoid releases the tension on this vocal cord, then the pitch of your voice gets lower. And when the arytenoids, a muscle pulls on the arytenoid to increase the tension, then the pitch of your voice gets what? Higher and higher and higher. Right? Mine doesn't change pitch very much, but that's how it theoretically can happen. All right, so the epiglottis, important for swallowing. The vocal cords are important for vocalization. And then the thyroid cartilage, which is the superior cartilage, is there to maintain, to keep this larynx open all the time, as well as the cricoid cartilage, which is just inferior to the thyroid cartilage. And you can see that the cricoid cartilage completely surrounds or completely encircles or completely girdles the larynx, but the thyroid cartilage is primarily only in the anterior part. And then even down below, we've looked at this gland before, the thyroid gland that's inferior to the larynx, pretty close to it on the, you know where it is, anterior and lateral surfaces of the trachea. What else do I want to say about this? I want to find a better picture of a larynx, and this is a pretty good picture. Well, maybe I'll reveal the word slides so that you can see what's going on. So, epiglottis allows for swallowing instead of what? When it's working properly. Instead of choking, right? So that's a pretty important piece of cartilage. I wanted to go back to this slide because we see the naso, oral, and laryngopharynx. So the pharynx is right here. Some people I haven't told what the common name for pharynx is. What's the common everyday name for pharynx? That's your throat, right? Because you go, we look at your throat over here. That's a common passageway for food as well as air. And it's got some subdivisions depending on where it is. And then here is the larynx with these vocal cords. And you can get an inflammation or an infection of either of these two places. So what do we call an infection of the pharynx? It's called a sore throat because your pharynx is your throat. Right, but in a clinical setting, you could say sore throat, but probably more properly, you would say a pharyngitis. Right, if you're going to actually make a note in somebody's chart, you'd say pharyngitis. Right, and that hurts, and you might be able to see some pockets of pus here and there, especially on these tonsils. But you can also get an infection of the larynx right here. And what happens when you have an infection or an inflammation of the larynx? You lose your voice, right? And what do we call that? You all know that. That is what we call laryngitis because your vocal cords are inside the larynx right here. So a lot of this stuff you already knew, but maybe you just didn't put it together yet. Okay. So I think I'm done with this slide. Now I want to go back forward to take a look at the larynx, and I see just a little bit of the trachea. Here's your old friend again, the hyoid bone, to give you some scale. You know, that's a pretty small bone. Here's the thyroid cartilage. Here's the laryngeal prominence that's sticking out, very prominent in males, not so prominent in females. Males have a larger larynx. That's why their voices typically are a little bit lower because their vocal cords are bigger. They just vibrate at a lower frequency as a result of that. Then inferior to the thyroid cartilage is the cricoid cartilage. Right? And then down on the trachea, I see cartilages as well. So these cartilages hold the airway open all the time. Right? So if something, some food particle gets right on the other side of this epiglottis, it's going to fall right into the trachea. That's a disadvantage of the trachea, but it has to be held open all the time because when you exhale, you increase the pressure inside your thoracic cavity to exhale, and when you increase that pressure, if it was just a regular tube without cartilage, it would get squished, right? Just like your chest is squishing, and it would become occluded, so you would not be able to exhale. So that's why the cartilage is there, because you can only inhale if you do what first? Exhale. If you don't exhale, if you're only on inhalation like that, well, you can't inhale any more air, and that's bad. So you got to be able to exhale and inhale to bring oxygen into your lungs. Some people have difficulties inhaling. Some people have difficulty exhaling. People with emphysema have difficulty exhaling, and they develop all kinds of muscles in their chest to force air out of their lungs as a result of that. Okay, let's look at another view of the larynx. Right, here's just a lateral view, and I can see the thyroid cartilage once again, this nice trapdoor, which is, what's the trapdoor called? Epiglottis, yep. And then the cartilage, which is even bigger than the thyroid cartilage and inferior to it, this is the cricoid cartilage. And it's a ring, it's a complete ring that holds the glottis open. The glottis is just the entry into the larynx. It's just a hole into the larynx. So I know you want to know the epiglottis, the thyroid cartilage, the cricoid cartilage, and then I promise I show you this cartilage that it's attached to this true vocal cord or true vocal fold, and that is the arytenoid cartilage. So those are the four that you have to know in lab. There's one other little one on top of the arytenoid. We don't have you identify that in lab, but you could. It's pretty easy. That's the corniculate cartilage right on the superior margin of the arytenoid. All right, so this is your larynx. Then we've got the trachea. And then on the posterior part of the trachea, right here, is a muscle. I don't know, does it look kind of red to you right in this region? That's the trachealis muscle. You do have to know that in lab as well, the trachealis muscle. Okay. And the trachea is just anterior to the esophagus, so the esophagus would be right here. I guess I want to go back to a couple previous slides. All right. So here's the trachea. Just behind it is the esophagus. And when you swallow a big piece of pizza, you have a big bolus of food right here. It would not be able to make it down to the stomach if these tracheal cartilages were a complete ring, because that bolus of food couldn't compress that tracheal cartilage. But since it stops right about here, when that bolus of food goes by, right, the trachealis muscle allows for a little indentation into the trachea that allows the passage of that bolus of food. All right, so that's some of the reasons why these cartilages evolved in those shapes and why it's there to begin with. Here I can see the vocal cords that are attached to this arytenoid cartilage. Okay. What should be next? I think I just want to close the digestive system down. Okay, so another good view that we have right here is a cross-section right through the trachea. And so here's the trachea, and you can see some nice hyaline cartilage. And here's the trachealis muscle that's posterior. And here is the mucosa, which is probably one of your famous or favorite epithelia, because it's a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium with goblet cells that secrete mucus. And we said that it is ciliated. So these cilia, what's the job of these cilia? Right here, these cilia. What's the function of a cilium or cilia, plural? They're for motility, right? They're moving, they're sweeping all the time. Because in air is loaded with dust particles and bacteria and all kinds of garbage that we breathe into our bodies. But these goblet cells secrete something onto the surface. What does it secrete onto the surface of the trachea? Yeah, mucus is secreted by a goblet cell, which is kind of sticky, which traps dust particles, right? And then that mucus with dust particles in it are swept by the cilia. And which way do the cilia sweep all that stuff? Does it sweep it down or does it sweep it up? It sweeps it up out of your body, because if it swept it down, then your lungs would fill up with mucus and dust particles. Okay, it sweeps it up into your mouth, and then what do you do with all that stuff that's in your mouth, the mucus and dust particles that are in your mouth? What do? Yeah, you just swallow it down, get rid of it. Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out, okay? Then that's very important, okay? So here's that nice hyaline cartilage. What I wanted to show you again, here is the esophagus, right? And when a bolus of food passes by the esophagus, it wouldn't be able to make it if this tracheal cartilage was a complete ring. So there's no cartilage on the posterior aspect of the trachea, but there is this muscle and some ligaments to maintain the integrity of the trachea. Okay, so let's move down. The bronchi, okay, we said there's a primary, just when the trachea bifurcates. So here is the left main bronchus, or left primary bronchus. Here is the right main, or right primary bronchus. And then when it bifurcates once again, that's a secondary bronchus going to a lobe of the lung. And remember, there are three lobes on the right. There's only two lobes on the left because of this cardiac notch making room for the heart. Okay, and sooner or later, we're going to run out of tubes that have cartilage in them. And the tubes that don't contain cartilage are what we call bronchioles. Let's see where we run into bronchioles. So here's a main, here's secondary, tertiary. We can't really see bronchioles on this illustration because they're microscopic. Okay, but they do not contain cartilage, but they do contain smooth muscle. So they can actually constrict. And guess what happens when they constrict? It occludes a bronchiole, so air can't move in and out of your lungs. Okay? And, of course, some people have problems with that. Let's see what this next slide looks like. Okay, that's a bronchus. Well, bronchus is going to have hyaline cartilage. It's going to have germinal centers in it. It has malt in there. That's not really a slide that I want to look at. All right, but this is one. Okay, so here is a bronchiole, and you can see that it does not have cartilage, but it has these little bands of smooth muscle. All right, so this is what we call a bronchiole. Here's a terminal bronchiole, okay, and then it bifurcates into respiratory bronchioles. And so these things can constrict. So when somebody's having an asthma attack, these are the muscles that actually constrict that makes it almost impossible for them to breathe. And so they need some medication to just relax these muscles, right? And it's a beta 2 agonist that causes relaxation of these muscles, and then the person can breathe again very, very nicely. Okay, so exchange does not take place in a terminal bronchiole, okay, but exchange can take place in a respiratory bronchiole because it has these little things that kind of look like grapes. These things that look like grapes, they're spherical structures. One is called an alveolus. A whole bunch of them, plural is alveoli. Okay, and so a bunch of alveoli in this arrangement is called an alveolar sac. And at the end of every respiratory bronchiole, you have these alveolar sacs. And even the respiratory bronchiole has an alveolus. So exchange can take place on a respiratory bronchiole, hence its name, respiratory bronchiole, which means that it's different than this terminal bronchiole right here. So we're very concerned. We want to know something about what the structure of an alveolus is, because that's where gas exchange takes place. Right, so we want to look, and I can see kind of like a crisscross pattern on this particular slide. And indeed, there is a crisscross pattern of blood vessels over this alveolus. And since exchange is taking place between the air and an alveolus and blood, guess what kind of blood vessel that is? That forms a network over the surface of an alveolus. What kind of blood vessel is specialized for exchange? A capillary. Yeah, so there's a capillary. So that gives you an idea of what the size of an alveolus is. It's very, very small. It's microscopic. You can't see them with your naked eye. Okay? And there are even pores between the alveoli. Okay, that allows for air to inflate all of these different alveoli. Okay, I'm going to go to the next slide. So here's a really nice, kind of fancy illustration of a terminal bronchiole and a respiratory bronchiole because it has some alveoli on there, then an alveolar sac surrounded by capillaries. But there's also a protein network that surrounds an alveolus, okay, within this capillary structure. And these are elastic fibers, right? And that's really important. So when you inhale, you use your diaphragm to inhale, and your lungs inflate, and an alveolus inflates. It kind of stretches out like a balloon, okay? And then when it's time to exhale, you relax the muscles, and what do these elastic fibers do then? What is an elastic fiber specialized to do? It's specialized to stretch without breaking, unlike collagen, and then when you let go, what happens to it? It goes back to its original length. So these elastic fibers right here cause the shrinkage of these alveoli to go back to their normal shape, and that forces the air out of the alveolus. So elastic fibers are really important. And when people have a disease that damages these elastic fibers right here, then they can't exhale. And if you can't exhale, guess what you can't do? You can't inhale either, right? You can't get air into these alveoli for exchange. Right, so that's a pretty terrible situation. So you see how delicate the lungs are. And we're going to look at the microscopic structure of an alveolus in a second. And it's real important to maintain these elastic fibers and this capillary network and not to load them up with all kinds of obnoxious chemicals. Like, what am I thinking about? What is best not to do? Load these alveoli up with tar, for instance, that you get from cigarettes, and tar from marijuana and things like that. I know there's a big discussion about legalizing marijuana, but marijuana is even more damaging to lung tissue than cigarettes, right? And I just hate to see people sacrifice their pulmonary function. Okay, so be careful with what you put in there because these are really delicate structures. Okay, so now we zoom in to an alveolus right here, and I can see a nice epithelium that makes an alveolus. If you're going to classify this epithelium right here, what would you classify it as? It's a simple squamous epithelium because it's really thin and that allows for exchange of molecules that are in the air inside the alveolus and the blood, which is right here. So this is a really narrow space because diffusion can only take place through very thin structures and over a very short distance. Within the alveolus, okay, I see some macrophages. So these guys are running around and they're looking for dust particles, okay, tar particles, bacteria, viruses, fungi, all kinds of things that we breathe in our body. Okay, but if you smoke cigarettes, they get overwhelmed. They can't clear all the tar out of your lungs. Okay, but I see another kind of cell as well. Right here are the cells that make up the wall of the alveolus. Okay, and then here is another one over here. Not really labeled, but this one makes a, here it is over here labeled. This is a special cell that makes a chemical called surfactant. And I'm going to bring in a demonstration next time. I forgot to bring it in. Okay, and what surfactant does is that it kind of counteracts one property of water. And I'll have to prove this to you next time. And I could start by just asking a question. Is water slippery or is it sticky? Okay, and I need to change your opinion on that really, really quickly because it's important. For sure, if there's water on a little tile floor or linoleum floor and you step on that water, you might slip. Okay, so you might think it's slippery. But, okay, have you ever been out walking around in a forest or a meadow or something and you see a stream or a little pond? And there's insects that can actually walk right on the surface of water. And that's because the water molecules are sticky. They do like to stick together. So we call that surface tension. And as a matter of fact, you could do this experiment at home before the next class. Get a couple little saucers that you put a teacup on. Okay, make sure they're dry. Put two, one on top of the other. Lift the top one up when they're dry, and guess what will happen? The top one will just come right off the bottom one. But now put some water, and this might ring a bell for you automatically, put some water between the two little saucers and just lift the top one up, and what happens? The bottom one comes with it because water is not slippery, it is really sticky. Water really is sticky. And since we have water in the lungs on the surface of this alveoli, guess what would happen to them? Just like those saucers that had water between them, the alveoli would collapse and the opposite walls would touch each other, and then you couldn't separate them, and then you can't inhale when that happens. All right, and the chemical compound responsible for defeating that purpose of water, defeating surface tension, is called surfactant. Surfactant is very important. Without surfactant, then we won't be able to ventilate or bring air into an alveolus, and then you won't have exchange taking place. So premature babies have difficulty, have reduced pulmonary function because their bodies can't produce surfactant yet. All right, so they have extreme trouble inflating alveoli. And so commonly what do we do for a premature baby that has decreased pulmonary function because they're not producing surfactant yet? They add an incubator which has high concentration of oxygen, right, which compensates for these alveoli which can't expand to their normal dimension. So that's pretty important. But if there's a disease process that affects these type 2 surfactant secreting cells in an adult, okay, then you'll have the exact same problems. Okay. All right, so let's look at the special junction between the air and the alveolus and blood, and in particular red blood cells that are in this capillary. So we're going to zoom into this region. So this is where gas exchange takes place. So CO2 in your body leaves the blood and it goes into the air and the alveolus, and then what do you do with that CO2? You get it out of your body, okay? And then your alveoli collapse because of those elastic fibers, and then, thank goodness, what can you do? You can inhale, and that brings oxygen into the air inside this alveolus, and oxygen can move across this membrane, and the job of this red blood cell is to pick up oxygen and carry it everywhere in your body. So that's a job of the red blood cell. So this special membrane right here is what we call the respiratory membrane. And it, again, is a very delicate structure, and it has four components to it. It has the wall of the alveolus, nice simple squamous epithelium. It's got the wall of the capillary, and who can tell me what kind of cell makes the wall of a capillary? It's an endothelium, right? It's an epithelium, but it's specialized for exchange. What kind of epithelium or endothelium is specialized for exchange? Simple squamous. So that's another simple squamous epithelium. And then there's a basement membrane, and it's a very thin basement membrane that connects these two cells together. And then, which is not on your diagram, but I would like for you to know this one, and that's there's a coating that lies right on the surface of this alveolar type 1 cell, right, and that is surfactant. So there's a layer of surfactant right here. So I actually like to think of the respiratory membrane as those four components. Starting with the alveolus, you have what? Surfactant. You have the wall of the alveolus. You have a basement membrane, connective tissue, and then you have the wall of the capillary. And this is extremely thin so that exchange can take place right there. Okay, so that's where oxygen gets into your body. Okay, so this lower respiratory tract can be characterized as having a conducting zone. It just moves air in and out of the lungs. These things, most of them contain cartilage to keep that airway open. Bronchioles do not. Okay. And then when we get into the respiratory zone, right, then these bronchioles might have one or two alveoli on them. An alveolus is specialized for what? What is an alveolus specialized for? Because of this respiratory membrane. Yeah, and I see these arrows right here. Exchange, because they're capillaries, right? And even the wall of the alveolus is almost like a capillary because it's a very thin, simple squamous epithelium. Okay, I think I talked about all of this stuff already. So which of the above contain cartilage? You should probably know that. Starting with the larynx. Does the larynx have cartilage? Yeah, give me the name of one. Cartilage in the larynx. You got to know four. There's a little bit more than four, but you got to know four. Thyroid cartilage. One below that, cricoid cartilage, one that works the vocal cords, that's the arytenoid, and then there is everybody's favorite one, which is the trapdoor, that is the epiglottis. Those are the four you have to know, and in lab you'll get a really good view of them in the models that we have, the plaques, and we have a nice larynx model. Okay. Okay, cavities. We know that the lungs are a visceral organ, right? It's not part of your superficial part of your body. It's deep inside a cavity. What kind of cavity are the lungs in? Could you name a cavity? You have a good shot because you have a couple cavities you could pick from. Somebody said plural. Indeed, you're right. All right, so the lungs are in the pleural cavity, and it's a cavity that's not open to the outside world. It's a cavity, all right, on the exterior of the lung, right? Not the inside. The inside has these alveoli right here, but we're talking it covers the surface of the lung. Let's see what this picture looks like. Pretty close. All right, so on the surface of the lung, okay, we have a special kind of membrane. All right, but the lungs are in the pleural cavity, and the pleural cavities are in what cavity? The thoracic cavity, and the thoracic cavity is in which cavity? The ventral cavity. Yeah, so you should be able to break it down in just that fashion. Okay, so here is the surface of the lung. The pleural cavity is not open to the outside world, so it has a special kind of membrane. Does anybody know what kind of membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world? As opposed to a cavity that is open to the outside world, like oral cavity, nasal cavity. So there are two general kinds of linings or membranes that line a cavity. One that's open to the outside world, called a mucous membrane. Sometimes they have goblet cells that secrete mucus, but it doesn't have to. It just has to be open to the outside world. Your oral cavity doesn't have goblet cells, doesn't really secrete mucus. That's a pretty good example. All right, but a membrane that lines a cavity not open to the outside world is what we call a serous membrane. Okay, so the thoracic cavity has a serous membrane. The pericardial cavity has a serous membrane around it because it's not open to the outside world, called the pericardium. And the abdominal cavity and pelvic cavity have a membrane around it, which is a serous membrane that we call the peritoneum or peritoneal cavity, right? That surrounds the abdominal and pelvic cavity together because there's really nothing that separates them. All right, so here are the pleural cavities, and so there is a pleural serous membrane on the surface of the lung. And remember, a serous membrane has three main parts. There's one part that's right on the surface of the lung, connected to it. And there's even connective tissue that glues it to the lung very nicely. We call that the visceral pleura. That's just the visceral serous membrane, right? Because the lung is a visceral organ. And then there's a space filled with fluid. And then on the thoracic wall or pleural wall, there's the third division of the serous membrane, and that's what we call the parietal division of the pleural membrane, or the parietal pleura. Okay, and does anybody know what the space is between the visceral and parietal pleura is called? Okay, that's just a pleural cavity, and it's filled with something, serous fluid, or you could say pleural fluid, and it's kind of like glue. And if you want to put glue in there, what kind of fluid would you put? Because now you know it's kind of sticky. Water. Yeah, so it's a very watery kind of fluid without surfactant. So that kind of glues the surface of the thorax to the surface of the lung. So that when we expand our rib cage, when we breathe, guess what happens? Since you have water in here, that pulls the lung, that helps inflate the lungs as well, helps make the lungs bigger. Right? Just like if you were to lift up the saucer that has water between both of them. If you were to lift one up, the second one would come with them. So when we have these intercostal muscles expanding the rib cage, right, because of that serous fluid, right, it expands the lungs, which is a totally different kind of fluid that lines the alveolus. All right, so the serous fluid in the pleural cavity is sticky, but what about the fluid that's in an alveolus? Should it be sticky? Remember, what does an alveolus have to do? It has to open. And if it's stuck together, if there's water inside of an alveolus, it cannot inflate. That's why there's surfactant. So the fluids have two totally different natures. One is sticky in this pleural cavity inside an alveolus. It's slippery so that an alveolus can inflate. Okay, so here we see a nice transverse section through the lungs. And this is a pretty good figure because I can see a membrane right on the surface of the lung. I don't know if it's labeled on this diagram or not, but I want you to be able to label it right now. What would you call this membrane right here? Oh, it is labeled if you search. But don't look, just tell me. This is the visceral pleura because it's right on the organ, surface of the organ. And then here is the space filled with sticky serous fluid. And then here is the membrane that's on the thoracic wall, and that is the parietal pleura. Okay. You can get an inflammation of this pleural membrane. You can, and fluid will build up in this serous space, the pleural space. Anybody know what that infection on the outside of the lung is called? Inside, usually we call that pneumonia, but on the outside right here, it inflames these tissues. That's called pleurisy. Indeed, that is pleurisy, where there's inflammation of this pleural cavity. And remember, the shape of the thoracic cavity changes all the time when you inhale and exhale. And if this pleural cavity is inflamed, then it hurts to breathe. As a matter of fact, it might hurt really bad to breathe. It might feel like somebody's stabbing you in the chest with a knife. Okay? And what would be your first choice? To be stabbed in the chest with a knife or not be stabbed in the chest with a knife? Not, because it's really painful. All right, so you have your choice. You cannot breathe and don't feel that pain of being stabbed in the chest. All right, but what does not breathing feel like? Oh yeah, you feel just as miserable when you don't breathe. So you're going to run into patients that feel absolutely miserable when they're inhaling, breathing, and they feel absolutely miserable when they don't breathe. So they don't know what to do. And when you're in that kind of pain and agony, what do we do for patients? Opiates, okay? And opiates then will take that pain away, and then they'll feel like breathing once again, and you'll be their friend forever, okay? So that's really nice when a patient can breathe, and then antibiotics to knock that inflammation down. But sometimes fluid can build up in this serous space, for instance, if somebody has a cardiac procedure or maybe a lung biopsy, lung procedure. All right, and when the serous fluid fills up, when the serous cavity fills up with fluid, it compresses the lungs, and then what happens to gas exchange? Then it can't happen, because when it gets compressed, air can't get into an alveolus, and then somebody has very poor pulmonary function as a result, and that fluid has to be removed. How could you remove fluid out of somebody's body pretty quickly? Jab a hypodermic needle in there and just suck it out. Right, so it reduces that space, and then somebody can inflate their lungs, and again, they'll be your friends forever if you can do that. Okay, that's really nice. All right, I think we talked about when, here is the heart, and the heart is not open to the outside world, so what kind of membrane is on the outside of the heart? A serous membrane, right? So here is the part of the pericardium that's on the surface of the heart. What do we call this? That's the visceral pericardium, because it's right on the surface of the visceral organ, just like this is the visceral pleura right here. Right? And then we have a serous space, and then here is the parietal division of the pericardium and the serous fluid. And serous fluid could build up inside this pericardial cavity, and that's really bad. Just like if fluid builds up in the pleural cavity, you can't inflate the lungs, so you can't inhale. And if the pericardial cavity fills up with fluid, guess what happens? Then the heart gets compressed and it can't fill up with blood. It might contract, but if there's no blood inside of it, then it can't maintain your blood pressure. Okay? And that's a very dangerous circumstance. And sometimes, guess what? You have to jab a needle in there and suck that fluid out. But of course, treat the underlying symptoms for that as well. And that could be due to surgery or any kind of inflammatory process. Okay, this slide is also good because I see some blood vessels. Here's the heart, right? And here is the most anterior vessel coming off the base of the heart, which you should all just yell out. What is that called? That's the pulmonary trunk. If you said pulmonary artery, that's okay with me. Okay, but pulmonary, because this is pumping blood, or is it receiving blood? Pulmonary artery. It's pumping because it's an artery. So blood is leaving the heart from the right ventricle, we see right here, going to the lungs, and it's colored blue. Why is that? Because, I wouldn't say artery or vein, I would say because it is low in oxygen. Blood that's low in oxygen will sort of have like a little bluish color to it. And why is it going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, right? So blue blood is going to the lungs. So all these blue blood vessels are what kind of blood vessels? Blue is deoxygenated, but I want to know, is it an artery or a vein? It's an artery. So all the blue blood vessels in the lungs are arteries. Then the blood undergoes exchange with a capillary. So oxygen enters the blood, turning it what color? Nice red color. And then CO2 leaves, goes into the alveolus. All right, so if I point to a nice red blood vessel right here in the lungs, you're going to call that what, an artery or a vein? It's a vein because this one is bringing blood back to the heart, in particular the left atrium and then the left ventricle and then out the aorta, bringing that oxygen to everywhere else in your body. So remember, there's two circulations. You have the systemic circulation starting here at the aorta. I see the nice aortic semilunar valve right here. That's the beginning of the systemic circulation, bringing oxygenated blood to most places in your body. The second circulation is the pulmonary circulation, starting with the pulmonary trunk, taking deoxygenated blood to the lungs, returning oxygenated blood to the systemic circulation. So remember, how many sides does the heart have? Two, because there are two circulations, pulmonary and systemic circulation. So the heart really is two pumps, back to back, right, with different circulatory systems between them. Okay, so that's something about the membranes in the heart, gas exchange. I think I can talk about this just a little bit, but I think, I'll talk about this a little bit. Okay, there are 300 million alveoli in our lungs when we're young, and then they start to decrease after that. We lose pulmonary function just as we get older. All right, so if we were to take, let me find an alveolus. Let's go back to an alveolus. All right, let's take an alveolus and cut it so that it's flat. Okay, and then let's take and then put it down on this table right here. All right, sort of like peeling a grape or an apple or something, put that peel on the table, and then get the next alveolus and cut it, peel it so that it can lay flat on the table. And then the next one. And how many times did you have to do that? 300 million times. So we're not going to take time today to do that. But just think, we took all 300 million, cut them, laid them flat on a table. How big would that table be? Okay. Or more importantly, how do we want to consider that tabletop? What can you do with a tabletop? Well, you can put junk. You can put a candlestick, a wine bottle, turkey, you know, cranberry stuff. And the bigger the table is, the more stuff you can put on top of it, right? But what's that function of an alveolus again? It just doesn't hold something. It's for exchange, gas exchange. So the bigger the tabletop is, then what? More oxygen can be exchanged or less? More, right? So and we call that a surface area, right? The surface area is just the height of a surface times the width. We can calculate the square inches or square meters of a surface area, and as it gets bigger, then exchange increases. So let's look at the surface area of this door right here. Here's just a little pedestrian door. People can walk in and out of this door, but could you drive your car through this door? No, it's too small, right? But how many people could go through this doorway, maybe at one time? Three, maybe four, get a running start, four maybe. But you could calculate the surface area of this door by doing what? Measuring the width, and look at that. This is a meter stick. It's exactly what? 1 meter wide, and multiplied by the height. Now we have to measure the height of this door. So here is 1 meter. Okay, and then we multiply these numbers together. Here's 2 meters. Right? It's exactly 2 meters. Isn't that handy? So it's what? 1 times 2 or 2 square meters. That's the surface area. But now we're thinking about cars. Think of a garage door, which is what? A lot bigger. It's going to be maybe 2 meters tall, and it's going to be maybe 10 meters wide. How many people could go through a garage door at one time? Well, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, many more than this one right here. So as the surface area gets bigger, right, there is more surface area for exchange. Okay, so when I say surface area, I automatically want you to think of a physical structure you're very familiar with, which is, what's that thing there? Doorway. So when I say surface area, it's a doorway for what? When I say surface area, it says doorway for exchange. Just like you can go from the room to the hallway. That's exchange of people walking in and out of the room. All right, so let's figure out if we take all 300 million of those